Hi, if I could take a moment of your time before we start, if you've enjoyed previous episodes or if you enjoy this episode, if you could subscribe on the platform that you listen to, that would be really helpful. It helps us get more guests and push the podcast forward. Thanks.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to the Car Chat podcast. I'm Sam Moores, and with us today we have Matas Buzelis. Hello.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Yeah, welcome. Can you tell the listeners a little bit about who you are and what you do?
Yeah, as you already introduced me, I'm currently the head of communications at CarVertical. CarVertical is actually a pretty fresh platform for car history checking. But in the industry, in the automotive industry, I've been in about 10 years. So before I was even a motoring journalist, after that, I've been working with automotive classifieds. So basically, that's more than 10 years in the industry. I'm also the president of the Association of Automotive Intelligence. This is our newly established initiative for them to bring the more transparent used car market, you know.
Okay.
And yeah, I'm a big fan of cool cars, and I'm a petrol head, should I say?
Yeah. So how did you? So when you sort of started off, how did you end up? Did you go straight into automotive journalism, or did you have a little path on the way there?
You know, while I was studying, I was looking for a job that I could, you know, because at that time I had a quite a rare car, an A86, the Toyota Corolla GT.
Oh, yeah.
Which is exclusively rare here, but I needed money, so I was looking for a job, for a side job, and eventually I found, you know, you have this auto car magazine. So we had this franchise in Lithuania, and I was basically translating text from English to Lithuania.
Ah.
And I was, you know, getting to know people in the automotive media. I was introduced to them, and the contacts were spreading, and I was like, you know, getting to this industry step by step, you know, slowly. So eventually, yeah, I found myself, I translated a lot of texts. I've been working this job, which was like a part-time job for like 4 years. But at that time, I was looking for a better paid job. And yeah, the journalist position was looking very nice because, well, you know, you also write texts, but you get this... this cars to try, you know, which is perhaps the cherry of this job. I still miss it, you know, because we used to try a lot of cars. Perhaps it was not the best. I mean, it's very different from what the best journalists in UK test, really. Because we tested cars like, you know, it's like Dacia Duster, which I particularly like, you know, the car. I think it's quite funky. But it's mostly mainstream cars. We don't get exotics or very powerful cars. And if we do, then we are very limited in terms of what can we do with that car.
Yeah.
We can't push them to the limit.
it's quite different to what you see from, I don't know, I'm trying to think of a magazine that goes like Top Gear magazine in the UK. Yeah. The stuff they do, they're like, oh yeah, lend me this latest whatever, and then I'm going to go and drive it 3,000 miles.
Exactly. We can't do that. You know, for instance, in the UK, perhaps journalists get cars for like a week or something like this.
Mm.
We don't. If we get the car for a weekend, it's wow. It's a lot, you know. You can do a lot with a car. You can make like 500 miles trip, you know. But usually it's for the evening, you know. In the morning you have to bring it back. So and you don't, we don't have, since my country is relatively flat, we don't have a lot of windy roads. So we don't get like a place where we can test the car to the limit, you know?
Yeah.
Which does we that, all want to do. Yeah.
Yeah, for sure. Does that change the types of cars people buy?
I think it's pretty, it's you know, it's like a freight train, as I say. The used car market is like a freight train. Once it get going, you cannot stop it, you cannot turn it. It has so much inertia, if you know what I mean. So for instance, if people started buying cars like they got used to German cars, especially in our country, in Lithuania, it's little likely it will change rapidly. It's little likely they will instantly start buying, you know, French cars or Japanese cars. In the new car market, things are pretty more dynamic, but in used car market, it's very conservative, should I say? Yeah.
I feel like at the moment we're going through a bit of a transition like that. Where if you'd asked me or probably most of my friends, like, what sort of car would you be aiming to have? Most people were some sort of German saloon, whatever, something. That was the sort of kind of the bar. And then if you go above that, exotics, whatever, like British, Italian, et cetera, et cetera. But definitely moving into EVs, like from my personal choice, there's so many other brands now that I look at and go, they're doing good things.
Yeah.
And I, you know, this historical Germanness, for example, is taking a real beating, specifically in EVs, I would say. Do you see that?
I mean, I treat EVs as next generation cars in general. I mean, the way we drive, the way they, you know, they perform in the straight line, the way the easiness of operating a car is on another level. It's not even comparable to conventional cars, I think. So it's basically, they are more smart, you know, smarter than these cars with internal combustion engines. I think even, you know, the absence of manual transmission makes it so much easier to operate and to start driving. It's easy as never been before, you know. So I think EVs are the next generation cars in general. But that being said, you know that they still have some problems like the conventional cars had. For instance, when it comes to the topics about, for example, the used car market, the fraud that basically was for the cars with the petrol and diesel engines, it still is there in the electric cars sector. So
do you mean things like clocking and stuff like that?
Exactly. Because when I find myself, when I found myself in Car Vertical, which is a company, I think 5 years old company, and 2 years we are all already operating in the UK, we observe that the level of fraud is not going away. You know, that people are still clocking cars and masking damages. For example, if the car had a severe damage, they try to sell it like a good car. And because of this information asymmetry between the seller and the buyer, the sellers, well, it is likely they have more information or different information than the buyers, you know?
Yeah.
And because of this asymmetry, they are still clocking the car and taking damages and taking more money for that particular car, you know? So it's not going away. And the same is for the electric, for the petrol and for the diesel cars. It doesn't matter what generation is the car.
Yeah, it's a really interesting one, that one, because I was looking at just chatting to a friend about Ferrari 458s recently, and we reckon, like, in the UK, I'm gonna make a bit of a claim here, but if you look at used Ferrari 458s, none of them have done many miles. None. Yeah. They're all under like 10,000 miles. All of them, every single one. Whoa. And well, okay, maybe not quite, but you know, like most of them have not done very much. And I remember when they came out, I remember in the years afterwards, you always see people driving them. People were driving their cars, yet none of them seem to have been driven that much. And I don't think, like, if you bought one now, you're going to drive it. So a lot of those cars, a lot of cars have been clocked. We sort of know that it was quite easy to do at the time. But how do you... you know, how do you get information to sort of counter that if it's all digital and someone can get their laptop and just go, just change the numbers, some ones and zeros and whatever?
Yeah.
How do you combat that?
You know, this is the thing that, you know, cars are advancing and so is technology and so are the scammers. So they are getting, you know, some tools to tamper with information, with car data. And, you know, if clocking was a physical thing to do 20 years ago, it's not physical now, you know? Now you just connect to the car and you replace numbers here and there. And that's it really. But, you know, our platform, with this platform, with Car Vertical, we decided to fight this. So we take information from many data sources. We have, I think, more than 900 data sources till this day, you know, and we connect, like, you know, events like damage event, technical check, technical inspection, MOT inspection, car registration facts, you know, so things like that. And if these events have odometer readings, it's good, because then you can see what was the graph of mileage, you know?
Yeah. And
sometimes we see severe drops, you know? I don't particularly know many examples when it comes to exotic cars. But for example, we saw some cars in Finland, you know? Some taxi cars that had 800,000 kilometers, which is, I think, about 500,000 miles.
Yeah.
And they were rollbacked to 200,000 kilometers, which is 120,000 miles.
Yeah.
So imagine this, you're buying this car and then you're like, you don't know the schedule of the maintenance because it's way off, you know, it's gone. So huge problem. And our data guys, they told that, cars with clocked mileage, they usually cost up to 25% more than the same cars, you know. So this is a big thing, and we must fight that.
it's mental, and I guess if you can get all those data points or lots of data points every time the car's had something done, if it's been logged, then actually your scope for clocking and getting, you know, not getting caught is quite tricky because you've got, let's say, a year, and you can only do the number of miles you've done in a year. If it's, you know, say a high end sports car or something, and then you can put it back to, but it has to kind of be a reasonable number down. Yeah. So it still needs to go up. But yeah, when you do something like your car with 800,000 kilometers back down to 200, most people would look at the car and go, well, it's done a lot of kilometers anyway.
Yeah.
I don't know. But the value difference, as you say, is huge.
You know, there are also some tools that you can install some devices to the car. And what they do basically is they reduce the rate of mileage, like how the odometer works. For instance, if you done 100 miles, it shows that you've done 10.
Yeah. Wow.
How to fight this? It's impossible. It's impossible. I mean, the only thing that you can basically do is to inspect the car physically to assess the wear and tear of the interior, to compare the aspects of the car, and then try to connect it with the mileage. And in some cases, it might not make sense. So
The interior is quite a good one, isn't it? Because not many people are going to replace interior stuff. Yeah. So, but you still need your sort of data points. You still need to go, well, this is what a typical 20,000, 50, 100, 300 looks like. And then pull it together. How does...
You know, even though if they replace some parts, for instance, it's very easy to replace a seat or a steering wheel. It's really easy. But they usually don't replace things like floor mats, like door panels, you know. It's windows, because the windows are going up and down and you can all see all these scratches, you know, on the side windows. Mm. So there are parts that needed to be looked very, very thoroughly, you know, in detail. Because they say God is in details. It really is, I think.
It just makes it as a buyer. It makes buying, let's say, a private sale significantly more interesting, because you're kind of, if you bought it, you bought it. That's it. You're not, not taking it back. The person's going to go, yeah, whatever, do one. Whereas a dealership, if you found out, you know, ultimately they are sort of liable. But it is, no one gives you clear, you know, you're not getting someone in for every single car that's a specialist on that particular car that will tell you how much it's being used or not. It's really, it's a really tricky situation. When I was sort of intrigued by this, where a friend brought it up recently, where he actually knew his car had been crashed, but he put it into a normal, HPI check, and nothing came up. And then you put it into a website like yours. I think it was actually yours. And it showed pictures of the crash and stuff like that, or the crash damage. How do you get that data? Like, who gives you that? And is it sort of readily available, or, you know, how do you pull that stuff in?
Yeah, well, we work with as I said, a lot of data sources. And we have, you know, among these sources, there are like our partners, like classifieds, for example, in some countries. There are governmental institutions like, car registries and even things like that. But we also have some private data providers, which are providing us with things that it's more tricky to get, you know. But in the end, you know, the benefit for the end user, for the car buyer, is massive because, well, as we say, any used car is basically a cat in the bag. You get this bag, there is a cat, and you don't know what kind of cat, what is the character of the cat, you know? What, you don't even know the age, even though, for example, when you go out to the shop and you buy a piece of meat, for instance, you see an expiry date.
Yeah.
But when you buy a used car, you don't see any expiry dates, you know? No. So, but you're paying so much more.
So much more.
Yeah. So that's the idea of the product and of the data variety. I mean, we connect a lot of data sources every year, you know, to make it better and better to fight fraud, you know, because, for example, in the UK, things are not really that bad as in the mainland Europe.
Okay.
You don't have a big market of imported cars because, well, they are slightly different, let's say, than in the rest of in Europe because of the steering wheel is on the right hand side, you know. But in mainland Europe, the movement of the cross-border movement of cars is massive. I think in 1 year, there are more than 2 million cars exported from Germany. And Germany is the largest used car exporter. And so all the cars from Germany are going basically mostly to east and to the south, you know. And in the West, the trust and the transparency in the used car market is better. So in the East, it's worse. And we have this, it's endless, I think, you know, and historically it was like this 20 years ago. It is now, I think, and in the future it will also be. So in the UK, then you don't have this import, as I said. Well, all the imported cars are, I assume there are quite a lot of exotic or muscle cars from the United States. There is
not a lot.
Yeah, maybe not a lot, but out of the whole imported cars, then maybe you have some cars from Middle East, you know, and there are cars from Japan, perhaps, which is also imported cars. So but it's nowhere near when it comes to the imported car scale or levels in the mainland Europe. So the cross-border movement of cars, this is the reason why the data gets changed, you know, why the mileage goes from 800,000 to 200,000.
It's a really tricky one as well, because everyone's involved in it. Like, let's say, for example, you curb a wheel, whatever.
Yeah.
Lots of people curb wheels, and you get it refurbed.
Yeah.
You might get it done well or not. Yeah. And then in a year's time, you might sell the car, or you might get it done just before you sell the car, or the dealership might do it, whoever's done it. But no one is going to tell the buyer.
Exactly.
No one would mention that whatsoever. And you go, okay, that's fine. But it might not actually be a good refurb. And if you don't know your stuff, you're not going to see it. But down the line, it's worth less. Like it is worth a bit less. And I feel like all sellers, definitely in the car world, are ultimately, you're invested in not giving all of the information. You kind of go, you can have a look around the car, look at whatever you like.
Exactly.
I'm not going to tell you anything until you specifically ask me, has this happened? Which it's got to affect all used car prices, because if they're all a bit rubbish, if all cars are like a bit worse than they say they are, then all cars are worth a bit less, because people are going to pay less because they don't believe you when you sell them a car. They're like, but you're not telling me the full stuff, so I'm going to price in the information. I've seen it on a small level on, let's say, eBay. If you give all the information, you say everything, you photograph everything, you get the best price. Whereas lots of people assume that if you put one photo up, then people will just buy it, but the buyers don't.
The example of a curved wheel is a good one, because sometimes you can also damage the wheel alignment. It can be off, you know. And when you come to buy a car, you can also you should inspect what is the tire tread depth, you know.
Yeah,
and sometimes one wheel is way more. It's gone basically. So you have to look to any details, and you know, even though if it was damaged and if the damage was not logged by the insurers or anywhere else,
yeah,
it means you're not going to find anything. So this is the problem of information. It's not all digital, you know?
Yeah.
And so yeah.
And if a car gets damaged,
yeah,
let's say I went out, crashed my car, and I know this, and I go, I'm going to get someone to repair it, but I'm not going to use it. Let's say you don't use insurance.
Yeah.
Does that automatically mean it doesn't exist? Or does it really depend?
This is a tricky one. Yeah. It goes to the shadow, you know, to the gray market. It's impossible to monitor everything. I think there will never be a tool that can detect such cases. I think it's impossible because, you know, if I hit a tree and if I simply like, I need to replace the front bumper, the fender and the headlight. If I buy these parts and I do it myself, all the job, it's not going to be visible in the history, you know?
No.
I think it's not a lot of cars that are treated like this, but when it is, it's usually bad. You know, you can see some tracks of like cheap damage, the cheap repairs. So yeah, buyers need to be aware and they need to be curious, you know?
Yeah. And I think it's probably through you guys. I've seen, we've worked with a lot of influencers and whatever, and so I've seen a lot of examples.
We're
of
good,
like,
at this.
I searched for this car, it looks fine, and then let's run it through the system and you go, oh, it's not fine. But so presumably if it's gone through insurance, that's one of your data sources. I know that if I've ever put anything through insurance, which is normally someone's driven into a parked car or something, which is incredibly annoying, but it goes through insurance, and then for the next 10 years, I'll get a phone call from someone saying, we know you were involved in an accident. Like, come on, guys. Can you not sell my data that quickly? Like, just...
Yeah, yeah.
But then you guys love it as well. You're like, yeah, we'll buy it. We'll buy it. Give it to us. Give it to us. Presumably, one of the things that you would like is for someone like Auto Trader or whatever, or all dealerships, to post your report on the sale. Are you trying to push for that?
Yeah, we're trying. You know, it's kind of difficult to get into the UK market because the competition in this sector is already, it's intense. It's not easy to fight, competitors, because they are, when we enter the UK market, and we entered the UK market with our elbows out, you know, we went out to the influencers and they are doing really a great job, I think. But we had to improve it a lot to get it to the really competitive level. So it's difficult. It's really difficult. I think our influencer marketing team, we had over the last year in 2022, we had 4,500 of videos with our integrations, which is a lot globally.
Yeah.
As we operate in, I think, 27 different countries. So it's a lot. I think in UK we have about 500 videos in the last year, which is awesome.
A big thing.
Because without this, you know, to scale the product, it's very difficult. To get to the media, it's difficult, you know. To prove our point to some classified websites like, I don't know, Piston Heads or the Gumtree or anything like this, it's also difficult. But in reality, for the end user, it's very convenient and it should be done, I think, one way or another, you know.
Because I only really looked at it from the, if I'm going to buy a car, I might use a website like yours to look through the history. But now I'm thinking about it, it makes a lot more sense if I'm selling a car. Yeah. If I'm selling a car and I know it's good,
Yeah.
If I don't exactly. know it, if I know it's not good,
then
I wouldn't do it. But if I know
it's nervous,
yeah, you might be a little bit nervous. But so you'd probably check. You'd check to see what comes up.
Exactly.
But no, if I'm selling a car or if I run a dealership and I'm selling cars and I know they're good, then ultimately, I feel like it would make more sense even if you know they're not good. Like you just sell them as they actually are. And when you're buying them off, if you're a dealership and you're buying a car off someone, check it.
Yeah, exactly.
So you know.
Exactly.
And then when you, so then you can say to the person selling it, look, here's the photos of it wrapped around a tree or whatever. It's actually only worth this and we're going to sell it for this plus our margin and everyone's happy. But if you get known as a dealership for providing the information in all the sales and go, look, here's the car vertical report alongside all the other stuff, rather than making you only pay for it once.
Yeah.
And you can, like, there's a tiny amount on a sale. Whereas if you're a buyer, every single buyer has to end it. Now, that probably makes more, be nicer for you guys financially if every single buyer ever runs the car through your website. But I think actually overall, it'd be better if all sales had it attached from the get-go. It would be a much nicer marketplace to buy and sell.
The level of trust would be on another level. Because
it's,
you know, that's what we're trying to establish with a B2B segment, you know. Because we sell these like history checks to dealers, and they, as you said, they show these reports to their customers on their own initiative.
Yeah.
I mean, the customers are not checking the car usually. Maybe they are, but the dealers are doing it in the first place. So this is a good practice, you know, to boost the reputation, for example. When you approach a dealer and the guys, the salesmen are not saying any details about the car, you might get a little suspicious.
Yeah.
But when somebody insists to see the history report, here's the report, please observe, you know, the damages and things. Because a damage is not a bad thing. It might be a scratch or it might be a chipped window, you know.
Yeah.
It happens. You can't run away from that.
Yeah.
But when a dealer shows these reports to buyers, they get this sort of like secure feeling, you know.
Yeah.
They get they build their reputation. And we had one case, you know, in Lithuania actually. It was I will not mention the brand, but it was an official dealership of the car. Mm-hmm. And they are also selling some used cars, you know, some secondhand ones.
Yeah.
And they were selling a car and it was expensive. It was a car for like 70,000 euros, which is like 62,000, I think, pounds or something like this. And the customer was like, can you provide me the VIN number, you know, because we check the history with the VIN number, not with a license plate, as guys in the UK do. And the dealer was very defensive from the very beginning, you know. Oh, the car is perfect. You don't need anything, you know. I can guarantee that there has been no accidents. The mile is genuine, you know. But it's suddenly when they gave the VIN number and the customer checked on our platform, they realized the car had damage in Germany for like 50,000 euros, which is...
Ooh.
More than half of the value of the car, you know. And there was a big scandal actually, and even the media was writing about this case, and the journalist did call me, you know, to ask like how did that happen, you know. I had to explain all the bits and bobs, you know. So
it's crazy.
I think the damage done to the dealer, instead of If he had this history report shown to the customer in the first place, it would be so much better. to sell the car.
So much better.
To sell the car with a discount, for example, because of some historical accidents or something like this, instead of trying to hide some information. So, yeah.
Yeah,
I think the dealers are taking these lessons because we are getting a lot of requests from dealerships, you know, from dealers, and they want to work with us.
Yeah,
especially when they buy the car from another country, when they import the car here and there. So,
yeah, it makes so much sense.
This is essential.
And if buyers start to use these tools, then dealers have to, because exactly. The cost of getting it wrong, if you try and
it's
sell
unbearable.
It and someone checks it, they're like, you've just lost like your margin for the month or whatever. Like, you know, you've got to sell so many legit cars.
Exactly.
So then could we end up with this situation, which would be interesting. It'd be quite cool, where cars have like a passport, like a digital passport for the car, that has all of the information in it. Because we sort of have now, previously, I'll just pull over here.
Yeah.
For those that are watching, there's like, I'm holding a bunch of box files. There's another one. My old 911 has three of these of stuff for it. Which is crazy. Like it's there's so much stuff in there from services and whatever, and it's an old car. But all the sort of newer cars I bought, probably in the last, I don't know, 10 years at least, all the servicing, if you use main dealers, is all digital. So actually, when I sell the car or whatever, you generally don't actually have a copy yourself. You might not have a copy yourself, and you just go, yeah, it's all online somewhere in some dealership. Here's the keys, which that's actually a lot worse. It's okay if you can check it, but I don't know how easy it is to check it as if you're buying a car versus here's a stack or even a USB stick, one or the other, with all of the stuff on it.
But you know, we're talking about the fraud, and there are people that fake these documents like you have. They can make these books, you know, these files, these documents, and they can write whatever they like.
That's true.
And the worst thing about this, that you cannot question whether these files are legit. How do you check? You know,
have to call each person.
Exactly.
And say,
exactly.
Is this real?
Exactly. Exactly. So imagine if the car had like 20 years of maintenance.
Yeah.
You're not, it's,
no.
I think it's work for a week to get everything right. You know?
And then if you don't end up buying the car, like, so you've got to, ultimately it's trust. It's like, it does come down to you. Do you trust the person you're buying it off? But yeah, some sort of digital passport would be quite interesting. That only... Yeah. If you've had it been to an authorized person, only an authorized person can like stamp your car's thing and it's on there, whether it's, I don't know, protected in the blockchain, whatever. Like you've got this thing that has all of the data for your car in it and you can't mess with it.
Exactly.
Someone's going to be able to mess with it though, aren't they?
Yeah.
People are smart.
You know, but in a way it's similar to that because a VIN number, vehicle identification number, is basically the same as our fingerprint. You know, it is unique. So if you can connect all the historical events to that particular chassis number, that's it. There you have it.
Yeah. If you make it mandatory from a legal point of view, that if you work on a car, you have to put it into the central system. You have to just stamp it or whatever.
Yeah. But you know, we are going to another paradox, because for example, UK is no longer in the EU, but in the EU, we have these paradoxes. For instance, both Sweden and Germany are the members of the EU, but the way they approach the whole, you know, the GDPR thing is very different. For example, If you ask German, a car seller, German, if you ask what is the VIN number of his car, he might call the police because, you know, it's his data, it's his mileage. It's,
yeah.
They are mad about this. But in the end, you know, the public interest is not protected, I think. Once the buyer are protected, the public interest is safe. So this is what they have in Sweden. They are 100% transparent in this particular area.
I think it should be logged. I think any person that's got a real reason why they don't want it logged, it's not going to be a good reason, is it? Like,
exactly.
Maybe no one can find it out. I don't like the system in Switzerland. Now, I've not heard a counterpoint where with license plates, where you can look up who owns the car and where they live.
Yeah.
Which, if you have like a nice car or just any car, to be honest, if someone pulls, you know, drives like an idiot and cuts in front of you or whatever, you can look up their address and go around their house and go, hey, what the hell are you doing? So, it works like that. But if, like with exotics, I've seen it all the time where someone will take a photo of a Pagani or something and they'll get a message being like, hi, can you remove the license plate? And you're like, I understand what you're saying and I get it, but you've bought a Pagani and you're driving it on the road. So people are going to know your license plate. I guess why you might not want it published like internationally, but the system is like that is a complicated system.
Yeah.
But we don't have that here, and I'm glad. Like I'm even now with online content of my personal cars. Yeah. I try not to. If it's a car that might live on the street or might live on the road or generally be seen around where I live often, I'll try and never post the plate, like ever. As soon as you've done it once, you might as well do it all the time. But just from like a personal security, whatever, I don't want people to know that's me. I'm at home. I'm not at home. That's where I live. Any of that sort of stuff. But
this is personal information, but when it comes to information like mileage, accidents, history, and stuff, it's cars information. It's not persons information. So we have to separate these two things, I think.
Definitely.
Yeah.
Yeah, it would be quite interesting if you could look up mileage. You know, someone saying they're driving their car. There was someone I know or know of who was driving. I knew he drove his car like all the time. And he's like on Instagram, had been on lots of road trips, loads of road trips, like across Europe, whatever, ever. Yeah. And then he sold the car and you saw the mileage when it was for sale. And you're like, nah, you've just fudged this. But there don't seem to be much repercussions. If you do it and you get away with it, happy days. Like, I don't know what the punishments are for lying about any of these things when you sell the car. Then they don't seem to be too bad.
I don't know what are the fines in the UK, but for example, in France, if you clock the odometer readings, you're fined for like 2 years in prison, and then you get on top of that, you get €27,000 fine, which is
that seems like a good punishment. Yeah.
Meanwhile, in Czech Republic, I think it's about €300.
Yeah, there you go.
If that gives you like extra grand value for your car, why not?
Yeah. If it makes you €400, you're going to do it. Like, well, you
in
might not.
At the end
of
the day, you have 100 left, you know?
Exactly. I'm just looking at a random Auto Express. They've got an article on mileage clocking and saying as part of a 2019 study, 443,000 cars were found to have mileage discrepancies. Now, I don't know what that works out as, like what a discrepancy is, whether it's like 10 miles out or they're just like Do you know that when it's said to have a mild discrepancy? Do you like,
yeah.
Is there a certain amount it has to be out?
Yeah, yeah.
Do you know the answer to that or not?
They should explain what they mean, you know, with that number. Because, for instance, we estimate that, I think in UK, it's about 15% of cars checked on our platform had mileage fraud.
Okay. And then presumably, people are possibly only checking on your platform because they think there might be something wrong. Do you know what I mean? If you might just go, nah, it's legit. I know it's one seller. I know that person. I'm not checking it. You might do that. You have to know about the platform.
I mean, in the end of the day, it's not that expensive to check, you know. But what can it do? It can get you this big advantage in negotiations. You know, when you see more data than, for example, the seller expects you to know, you get this better ground in terms of negotiations. So it's always, I think, worthy investment in this.
Mm. Yeah. I've just looking, scanning through this article again. It's come up with a reason why you might clock a car forward, which I'd never thought about. Have you come across this? apparently, if you have a company car.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
You know, you get paid for the mileage.
Okay.
But you might be allowed to do 20,000 miles a year and you get whatever, 40p a mile or whatever it is, something like that.
Yeah.
But you've not done the mileage and it's a company car and like you're not really paying extra. So what? It's going to go back at the end. So people get it clocked. Some people get it clocked so that rather than the 10,000 miles they've done, it's done 20,000 miles and they get a payment for the remaining miles.
Well, we didn't think how to solve this, you know.
not yet.
We have another.
That's not a problem.
We have another problem to solve.
As a buyer, that is a great problem. I would very happily buy and pay market price for a car that says it's done 20,000 and has only done 10.
But servicing would be an issue, though. Yeah. Servicing would be an issue. You need to know that this car had the mileage. It was moved to another direction.
Because you'll have a bigger, at some point in time down the line, you'll have a bigger service bill than should be necessary. But then, you might have paid half, you know, a lot less in the interim. It's a sort of interesting one. So one of the sort of things is what ends up on the platform and what doesn't. I think we sort of covered that a little bit, didn't we? Like if it's been through, it's got to be through one of these data points. If it's not been through a data point, if someone's done it themselves at home, it's not going to end up on there, is it?
Whatsoever. Yeah, it must be digital, you know. There still are some countries though. That have a lot of records, but they are, you know, they're handwritten. It's not digital.
An interesting one that I have an E208 Peugeot as a lease, which is going back. And I wish I'd bought it because that would have been a better financial situation, but whatever. And I'm looking at probably buying another small EV. But one thing that is quite difficult and not many people tell you is information about the battery.
Mm-hmm.
There's only a few. I've only heard of one, but I'm sure there must be more people selling EVs in the UK that do like some analytical tests on the car and give you some battery information. A bit like, I don't know whether on a Tesla you can just press a button and it tells you. They probably do, but I imagine every other manufacturer does not. Do you get? Are you have getting ways of pulling this information into the report?
I think we don't have and will not have in the near future such information about the exact the state of exact battery.
Yeah.
In electric cars, the battery life can be also reset, and it needs to for car to be charged for a couple of times. To get to set the number back, So I heard stories how people were buying an electric car with clock odometer, but the battery life, the computer showed the battery life was pretty good,
Yeah.
But after like a couple of weeks, it started to degrade, the number was decreasing. So yeah, this is a big problem. I think we're not. We don't know how to solve this yet.
I guess.
Well, you have to rely on the there should be a ratio of like mileage and the battery life somehow.
Yeah,
they should be connected. But the way people charge their cars are also different. Whether yes. it's high power, it's high current, or it's low power. Do you charge it all the way up to 100%? Or do you charge 80%? Yeah, exactly. All that depends, So I think it's a very difficult thing to measure. Although I think there are some cars that are relatively easy to inspect the batteries. For example, we have some guys that are inspecting. I think they are doing only with Nissan Leafs because they know how these cars work. Yeah. And they have some maybe equipment, some devices that connects to the actual battery.
Yeah.
And it shows the actual reading. So it's 100% trustable, information. But all the manufacturers are having like different infrastructure of their like electrical system. So it's impossible to apply this thing for everyone, and this is a problem.
Yeah, I guess
I think in general, electric cars, there are so many things that we don't know about them. We don't know what is it going to be in the future, What happens with a 20-year-old electric car, with an Audi e-tron that is like 25 years old?
Yeah.
Do you is the buyer going to replace the battery because the range will be like, 50 miles after 25 years. Yeah. So this is a problem. Another problem is also from the user's point of view. If the people are parking the car in the underground, parking areas, like below their apartments, what happens if the car caught fire? Have you seen any videos with Teslas being on fire?
Yes.
How do you fight this? I have no idea, actually. So it's
because if you're a manufacturer now, I presume Tesla have it. I've only seen it at Rimac, where there was a tour of the factory, and they're like, "This is where we assemble the battery packs, and this." All these ducts and cables, basically we can fill this room full of water, and it's a big room, and we have massive amounts of water that we just fill the freaking room with water, and it's going to keep burning until it's all gone. It does not go out. It just keeps going, doesn't it? You cannot put the fire out.
I think you have to wait. I think I saw, was it Yalopnik? I'm not sure which blog it was. there was a story about a Tesla. I think it was a P100T, the most powerful version up to the time.
Yeah.
It was on the track day and the car caught fire. So they were like the firefighters were spilling water like for hours.
Yeah.
And the fire was blazing all over the place. So what they did, they took this you know the machine that digs a hole. I'm not sure how you call it. And they pushed the car into the hole and then fill with water.
Yeah.
And after like hours, the car was done.
Yeah.
So
I know another thing people do.
What happens if the car is on fire in the middle of the night?
Yeah.
Is the whole building going to be on fire? I don't have the answer. You know, this is the thing that we need to think of, because I think the UK is going to electrification by 2030.
Yeah, apparently. Yeah.
So it's not all the time to get the solution, you know?
Yeah. And if you're in an underground car park, you've got it, and it's above a building. You've got a real problem. I know another way they dispose of, like, sort of sort them out is they get a big container, fill a container with water, and then they drop, like a big steel container, and they drop the car in. But, you know, that's all very well. And these are quite edge cases. Like, it's super rare for this to happen.
Yeah.
But it does, it can happen. And it is quite worse. I saw a video. It was someone's security video. They had a Taycan. This was quite early. I think they had a Taycan Turbo S, and it was in their garage. And there was like thermal runaway, and I think it sort of exploded. And it just like there was a big problem. You would not have wanted that in your house.
There is so much energy in the battery. It all needs to burn. So
I have
no idea what should they do.
I imagine there's lots around design and the evolution of battery packs and how they're, you know, I think you can now, some of the ways they're putting packs together, there's much less chance of like a runaway situation. And like, I think there's a lot going on in that space to make them a lot safer. But, you know, it's one of those things that probably all people that are sort of anti-EV are going to go, they're all going to explode. And like, the reality is they're not all going to explode, but it is a situation that they do need to, they presumably are looking at. It's an interesting space. I'm struggling at the moment trying to choose the next EV that I buy, because it's just like, I look at everything going on and go, it's going to be so different in like 2 years' time.
Exactly.
And 5 years' time and 10 years' time. So I struggle to go, I'm going to spend money on something now that like really could be, it won't be obsolete, but if let's say your range. Our little electric car only really gets used around town. So ultimately it doesn't need very much range, but we do longer trips. And in winter, the range is much less. So if that went down by 20%, there comes a point when your car becomes unusable for you, depending on how far you drive. Let's say you need to do 100 miles. If your car dips below 100 miles, you just can't use it at all.
Exactly. Like,
so it seems like with Tesla and their battery packs, like the Model S's that have been around forever, they're still going pretty strong. They've not hit that 80% degradation over 10 years, which is what everyone's sort of, you know, saying that they're done.
It's I think not a lot of years already passed, you know, so I have no idea what's going on, how it's going to be in the future, because now Tesla Model S, I think it's about 9-8 years, the car is already on the market. But what happens after 15 years? So this is, I don't know.
Yeah. I think, and especially look at, did you see the latest Tesla presentation that was like week ago, a few days ago, about, you know, their evolution of their platform and the next car, etc., and vertical integration, simplification, all that sort of stuff. And you go, oh, okay. So a Tesla Model 3, even now, when you compare it to other cars, it's like reasonably cheap as an EV.
Yeah.
They do all the stuff they're going to do or say they're going to do, because there's sometimes a bit of a difference between what they say and what they are going to do. But and they make the next generation of cars, but at another chunk lower and still maintaining their profit margins. You kind of look at other manufacturers and go, you guys, whether you want to buy a Tesla is a different matter, like whether you like them or not. But it's going to make it really difficult for other manufacturers if they can knock off 50% of the costs or 40% price reduction in their cars.
Yeah.
And then, like, if your car costs, the numbers they're sort of aiming, I think people are saying, it's like a $25,000 EV that could have 200 miles of range or 250 miles of range or something.
Yeah.
Like, this is going to be a pretty cheap car to own.
Exactly. You know, I remember the early days of Tesla. You know, every like experts and every like automotive people, they were like very not sure about the future of Tesla, because the traditional manufacturers are having they have so much more experience in the industry.
Yeah.
But what they did prove is that to build an EV, you don't need as much experience as you used to have, you know?
Yeah.
So I think this is a game-changing thing. And also, you know, speaking of EVs, China is doing also massive developments regarding the EVs. Yeah. And I think I was reading somewhere that by 2025, Europe will be an importer of new cars instead of exporter. They will import more cars than they will export, you know?
Yeah, so, very possibly. If like companies like BYD.
How many
cars do they make a year?
There are tens, if not hundreds, of different companies making EVs, like NIOs, you know, BYDs, and I couldn't mention five companies from China, but the level that they operate is through the roof. Yeah. You know?
I know. Like, I had not seen a BYD, and there's only, I think we've got the Atto 3 now. It's like the new one that's coming out here. But they've said, we're moving to the UK. We're going to start selling cars. And then they've said some number of dealerships they're going to have. And it's not like we're going to have... I'm just going to pick the number 10. I don't know what the number is, but I feel like, you know, it's something like that. But we're going to have them by the end of this year. And they've just announced they've opened two, I think, dealerships today. And these are like actual dealerships. So by the end of the year, there's going to be a bunch of BYD dealerships. I was driving around this morning and I saw one of the London EV buses. They're made by BYD. I did not know that. I just saw it on the front and was like, oh, right, okay. So they already make more buses.
They're already there.
Yeah. And then, like, you look at some of the cars and go, okay, it's not got the same, it's not got the Germanness of, you know, that sort of thing. But it's not, like, they are not making crap cars. They are making good cars. And they make millions of them.
You know, speaking of like, the quality of cars, I think we have to agree on this, that cars never felt so similar between different manufacturers before. Because I remember, you know, 10 years ago or 15 years ago, if you drive a Mercedes and then you drive a Volkswagen, you can see a huge difference in everything, in the layout of the interior, the quality of materials, you know, everything. You can feel massive difference. But now it's the competition is somewhere, it's very similar. Cars are very similar. And, you know, when it comes to these big groups like Volkswagen Group, WAG, you know, all the cars from Volkswagen, from Audi, from Seat, from Cupra, they are all the same, basically. You have this exactly the same, you know, multimedia systems, dashboards, seating positions, you know. They feel the same, the way the suspension work.
Yeah.
If you drive a Golf, if you drive an Audi Q3, it's the same car, basically, you know?
Yeah, so, it takes away the value, the premium value of some of these things, because you go, like, my little Peugeot, it's a good car. Yeah. Like, it's a good car. Exactly. Nice interior, nice infotainment. It could probably be a bit better, but it's, like, pretty decent. And you go, 15 years ago, I would not have considered it at all.
Exactly. It feels more premium than it is, actually.
Yeah.
What do you think?
Yeah. It's an interesting one. So you have this Association of Automotive Intelligence. What exactly, can you tell me about a little bit about this?
Yeah, this is our like newest initiative. You know, it's a non-profit organization that we are trying. What we are trying to do is we are trying to change some things in the used car markets, in the whole industry as a whole. Mostly, you know, different car dealers, they have different problems. For example, some Romanian car dealers have some problems. Polish car dealers have another problems. So what we're trying to do, we are trying to unite them, and then we're trying to address these problems to the authorities, you know, to explain that this is bad because of A, B, C, and D, you know. Maybe there are some possibilities to exchange the experience. For example, if guys in Romania, they still can, for example, sell a car, but give a buyer German license agreement, not purchase agreement. And then this is the way the seller erases himself from the transaction, you know. So in Lithuania, we fixed this. The authorities fixed this. So now we can exchange the whole experience and make it, you know, make the whole car trading environment safer. So this is the ultimate goal. Yeah.
Nice. What are sort of some of the steps you're, you know, pushing at right now? What have been some of the tricky bits?
Yeah, I think it's an early stage of the whole association. So we're still onboarding the members, you know, like every day or every 2 days, we have a meeting, an online meeting with dealers from foreign countries. And we are presenting this whole idea, you know, so what at this particular stage, what we need is them to believe in the idea, and that having the weight of the whole market, with the weight of the whole market, we can address these issues, as I said, to the authorities or even to the global organizations, you know, like European Commission. Because, for example, the whole GDPR thing, as I said, the paradox of, you know, data protection, the public interest, is also, I think it's not fair in the end of the day. It's the public interest is not protected in the end of the day. So what we're trying to establish with the association is to change that, you know.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah. Sounds like a good idea. All right. Well, I normally wrap these up with five questions. You ready?
Yeah, let's go.
Do you have a most memorable driving trip or journey?
I think I do, you know. My wife used to work in Italy, and I was in Lithuania, and I was like flying back and forth every like month or two, you know.
Yeah.
But then I bought a car. I bought a Mark 3 MR2 Roadster, the Toyota, and I decided to take it there to Italy in one take, you know. So basically I left in the morning, in the night, and in 20 hours, I think I covered about 1,900 kilometers, which is a lot when you think about it. Yes,
that is a lot.
Yeah, but the coolest thing is that I still had some, you know, some energy left, because when I left the country, I was like going through Poland, through Czech Republic, through Austria, and then Italy, you know. So right after I crossed the border of Czech Republic, there was a massive thunderstorm, and it was going like forever till the middle of Austria. So I was always busy, and it was never boring, you know.
Yeah,
because
yeah.
I was driving, and you know, there is lightning, there is wind, there is rain. The wiper blades are going, you know. It was lovely. It was actually lovely. And
that is,
you know,
I arrived
to the place, and I said, you know, I could do 500 kilometers more. But usually now, after like 300 or 400 kilometers, I'm done. I don't want to be driving.
Yeah. I'm trying to think of like the longest time wise. Because you can spend a really long time traveling in a car, but not actually cover a massive distance. But I think the furthest I've probably done, not that far, would be like UK to Austria. And I don't know, I think that was like an 18 hours or something, you know, some really seriously long time. But
you had some good roads through Germany.
Yes.
Because you have these autobahns, you know. But when you go through Poland, through Czech Republic, it's completely different. You have these road constructions, these like potholes.
Yeah,
it's completely different experience. You know, you're very much involved in the whole process. So yeah.
I did a drive on the Gumball 3000 actually, and one of the legs was St. Petersburg to where is it? Where do we end up? We ended up in Riga, but I don't know where we stopped. That drive was a similar sort of. You're never on a motorway. You don't seem to ever be on a motorway, just like kind of long country roads. And then you'd be driving along, and then suddenly half the road is just missing for 300 meters of just like,
the
road has gone. You drop down like whatever, 10 centimeters. And we were obviously, everyone was in sports cars and stuff. It was quite funny. And then you sort of pop back up and carry on. And yeah, those sorts of trips where your stuff is going on. There's things to do, things to see, changing scenery, people and whatever, are nowhere near as draining as sitting in traffic, like just stop, start, or slow behind another car for just hours and hours and hours.
Exactly.
You know,
sometimes me and my friends, it's another thing, it's not the favorite, the most memorable drive or something like this, but usually in summer we have with friends these meetings where we gather like 10 cars and we go to the coolest roads. But after each like 20 or 30 kilometers, we swap seats, you know. We sit in another car. And this is absolutely lovely experience, because then you get to try the cars like you know, R129 Mercedes-Benz SL500, you know, or BMW Z4 M Coupe, you know, something like these, or a Corvette, or Viper, cars like these. It's cool, you know.
Yeah, that aspect of a road trip. I haven't done a road trip in a while, actually, but we used to get probably four or five cars together and do a bit of a European road trip. And like you said, actually, that was always a lot of fun. And we didn't necessarily swap around that much. But swapping around, that is quite a fun, especially if you're just a passenger and you're driving a bit, but you're a passenger.
Yeah.
Like swapping into the other cars is great. Like you get to experience different cars. You're chatting to someone else. You know, you see the whole thing through a different angle. If someone else is driving your car, you get to see your car. You get to hear your car. Such a different experience. I don't know whether you saw it's just popped into my head, the Valkyrie or the launch sort of videos that came out last week. One of the things that stuck in my mind, and I don't know whether it's just the difficulty of recording noise in a car, but the in-car noise of that car doesn't sound anywhere near as good as the outside sound.
Exactly.
And
exactly.
Like all the exterior shots just are unbelievable from a noise point of view. But all the inside stuff just kind of sounds a bit, it just doesn't sound anywhere near as good. You get that thing, I don't know whether you've ever done it, where if you drive with some mates in the same cars, obviously we're not talking about a Valkyrie, but if you had a Valkyrie and some mates that had Valkyries, when your friend goes past you and you've got the same car, you're like, oh, that's what mine sounds like, you know. I'm looking at that car. I bought this car because I love that car, but when I drive it, I don't get to see it and I don't get to hear it anywhere near the same as someone else. So that's definitely a really good part of driving with other people. What do you think is the most undervalued car at the moment?
I think this is a difficult one. I usually find myself scrolling on sites like eBay or any other similar sites, you know. Undervalued car. I could actually say that the Mark generation, the Mark III generation of the Toyota MR2 might be undervalued, because these are much more rare when compared to Miatas, for instance.
Yeah.
But they will never be as valuable as a Honda S2000, for example.
Yeah.
So, I could see maybe some Mercedes-Benz, 190, the 2.3 16 valve, the Cosworth engine. These cars are quite
Super cool.
Yeah.
Definitely. If you could only drive one car for the rest of your life, and it can be a sports car, it doesn't have to do like everything, what would it be?
Perhaps a 911, I think. I think the 911 is the ultimate car, you know.
And then which would you pick?
This is the most difficult. In terms of looks, for example, the generation that I like the most is the 993, the last air-cooled cars.
Interesting.
I absolutely love these cars. And I saw one GT2 version in Italy. Mm. It was absolutely brilliant, you know. But I believe life with such a car would be so difficult, you know. It's not comfortable. The controls and the seating position might be not good enough, you know. So perhaps it would be a modern 911, maybe a... I love the GT3 touring version of the car.
Yeah.
I absolutely love that one.
Yeah. Yeah, I really like the 991 Gen 2 touring. It's like, well, that was the only touring, but that is like, it's just an amazing shape. And then actually 993, if I just think about shape of car, I really like the turbo.
Yeah.
I think the turbo is a really cool looking car. I actually got to drive a GT2 recently, about 9 months ago. It was for sale on an auction, and I got to drive it beforehand. And it's tricky driving a car like that, because you don't know whether it's a good example. You don't have the history. You don't. I didn't know anything about the owner, really, other than just here's the car, here's the keys, you can go and have a drive. And it was just super raw. All the stuff, but it was also on really old tires. And I don't know, hadn't been driven that much. So you're like, I've got to be careful here. But, but a really cool looking thing.
I think when you realize what is the value of the car, you're limited by that, by only knowing what is the value of the GT2, because these are monstrous prices for these cars. So
And then it's also, I don't think you can ever drive. Some people do, but I don't. I would never drive someone else's car like I would drive my own car.
Exactly.
And you can take that however you want, because people drive other people's cars in really bad ways and they wouldn't do it the same. But I would never push someone else's car, I don't think, the same as I would push my car. Just
a level. When I see, we have these like car sharing platforms, you know, when I see people smashing these cars like there's no tomorrow, I'm like, why would you do that? You know, it's a E208. Why would you do that with a Peugeot? You know, is this a Ferrari? No, it's not. You're not okay, going maybe to pull some records, you know. Yeah.
Maybe if it was a rental, maybe I would. No, I would drive my own car harder than someone else. Yeah, exactly. If it's a person's car that's let me drive it.
Exactly.
It's their car. I don't want to, you know, mess it up. What do you think is the most interesting car to you at the moment? What are you Googling? What are you looking up? What are you going,
I absolutely love the idea of the TVR Sagaris. I mean, for me, it is such an exotic car. It's completely different in every aspect. The way you look at it, you know, the way the interior is created, the door opening on the mirrors, the buttons, you know, quite recently, I think Pistonheads, they published a video of the Sagaris review. It's a beautiful piece of a machinery, I think.
It is. That is a car that it was the first and only TVR that I've ever been interested in, really. And I just remember when it came out, I was about that, it was about that age where you're like, ooh, what is this? Mm-hmm. And you could show me pictures of older TVRs. And I'm like, yeah, whatever. Show me a Sagaris. I'm like, no, but this is cool. And
they're
really cool. I like, if I had, I don't know, 50 cars, 100 cars, you know, one of those, like, would you have a Sagaris in there just as like a memory and a cool thing? And I bet they're quite fun to drive. Like, yeah, absolutely.
I absolutely love the way they are very unique, very, like, you know, very special. These side exhausts, this, you know, the transparent spoiler, the speedometer, you know, 20.
The flip paint.
The top speed is 20, yeah. I loved how Jeremy Clarkson, I think he said that the designers were lunatics and then the car was hit with an axe. So that basically describes the whole car, you know.
It
looks mega for me.
And they have done. If you bought a Sagaris like 5 years ago, they're now like, I'm just having a look on Pistonheads in terms of pounds. It's like £80,000 for a Sagaris.
Yeah,
they were like 40, 30 when I remember last looking.
Actually, the prices of used cars are going through the roof. I mean, I saw someone paying for the Acura Integra Type R in the States, $150,000 for the DC2 Integra.
Yeah, it's.
I think people have too much money. In the end of the day.
I think some people have too much money and they want to buy some of these cars. What was it? There was a Ford Escort, what was it? A Cosworth?
Cosworth.
That sold a couple of weeks ago for £500,000-£600,000 or something, dollars. I don't know.
It was Sierra.
Sierra Cosworth.
Sierra Cosworth. Yeah.
Like, fair enough. Someone wanted to buy it. And they
was RS500, the most powerful version. Lovely car, but $500,000 for such a thing. I think people have too much money.
maybe I don't know. There was two people that owned that car when they were little, and they're now billionaires, and they're like, "No, I want that one." I don't know
exactly.
Crazy, but I do wonder. You know, you make these calls, and then you go, that one would never be one for me. But in 10 years time, you know, what cars are we looking at now that are worth, like, is a TVR Sagaris going to be worth 200 grand in 10 years time? Who knows? It could be.
Who knows? It could be 3 years, 3 years from now. It could be.
I could see, you know, the good example with a good history that's not been crashed, that's verified and all that sort of stuff. And you go, right, there's not that many of those. And there's a bunch of people, let's say like us, that go, I think they're really cool. And then you've earned a lot of money and you're like, but I want one.
Exactly.
It could happen.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Final question. Five-car garage, unlimited value.
Unlimited value for five cars. Very. Also, I think every day I could come up with another set of five cars.
Yes, yes.
But for me, perhaps I would have an AE86. One nice. Of the car would be AE86 with a newer generation 20 valve, engine with a individual throttle bodies and things like that. Period, correct styling.
Yeah.
Watanabe wheels, things like that. So, nice. So this would be it. Then there would be perhaps the best daily car in the world, a fully kitted E-Class Mercedes-Benz estate car.
Mm.
Because the way these cars drive, I own actually one 2017 model.
Nice.
And I don't imagine a better car because it's silent. It's good for our shitty roads. Sorry for the language. Yeah. It's economical, practical, comfortable, and the audio quality, the system, the speakers are brilliant. So that's what you need in a longer trips, So that would be a good E-Class, but not the AMG because these are, equipped with these big tires that are not very good at potholes thing,
Yeah. I would agree. I have an E-Class estate, but I have the stupid one. I have the E63, and
okay.
I got it because I wanted the V8.
Yeah,
I've never had a V8 like that, and I was like, I want to try it. It sounds awesome. And then after about a month, I was like, should have probably bought the 350D or something, or a 53 or anything that didn't have the massive wheels. The wide wheels, like all the stuff, because it's not as comfy. It's pretty good. I've got the newest facelift, but like, I know if I had a lower down model, it would be much more chilled out, which is kind of what that car's for. But the E-Class platform as an estate, I still believe is the best of the bunch of that.
Yeah,
it's got the most space by quite a long way of the nicer German ones.
And right, the acoustic comfort, acoustic comfort, the sound insulation is beautiful. These cars, I'm like going like, what is it like about perhaps 90 miles per hour when I'm going to the seaside.
Yeah.
And it's silent, I can still whisper and guys are hearing what I'm saying. Where in the, in the Audi similar models or BMW, it's good, but not as good as the...
Not as good, yeah. The AMG is worse. Yeah. It's got too much tire.
So, okay, another car. Because we have quite an aggressive winter, I would need something with all-wheel drive and proper differentials.
Yeah.
That would be a Subaru Impreza 22B.
Nice.
This bad boy version,
Yeah.
Then it would be perhaps a 911 GT3 RS, maybe for the track day experience.
Would you get the and current
ultimately,
one?
The current 992? One I think is why not? I quite fancy the car.
Why not?
And if the budget is unlimited, and if the world is an ideal place, a McLaren F1.
Which
for me this is the ultimate car in the history. I think even the GMA T50, it's not going to be as cool as the F1 is. I mean, the performance wise it will be on another level.
Yeah.
But the F1, the design, I absolutely love the car and I love the stories from Mr. Murray. I heard hours of him speaking about the car, and a big fan of Mr. Gordon Murray.
Yeah,
the car is a masterpiece.
That's a really interesting one, because for me, F1 and like GTR, because I think the GTR looks the coolest. Short tail has been like at the top of the tree for a long time. Zonda was up there for a long time, but I think F1 GTR is probably like a bit above that. And then, since these new cars, the T50 and the T33,
yeah,
T50 I think looks a bit funny. Just doesn't quite.
I don't quite get it, you know. Yeah, I don't like the fan. The rear end looks a little bit, you know, compromised.
It's a bit weird. But when you hear him talk about it and why, etc., I would, you know, in the dream situation, I would be able to drive a T33 and then a T50 back to back, maybe with an F1 GTR and an F1, you know, why not? And see what the difference is between a T33, which doesn't have the fan, and a T50, which does have the fan. And then maybe you drive it and go, oh yeah, but it's way better on the road because it doesn't have to have so much downforce, whatever all the stuff is. But I imagine as a car to own, see, I see like a F1 GTR for me is like the poster car. Like, just look at it and go, I imagine driving it would be very cool, but driving something like a T33 might be, it's probably going to be, I like kind of modern-y stuff, and I imagine the engine's going to be more rowdy, it's probably going to ride better, the brakes are going to be better, the tech, you know, all the stuff's going to be in theory better, maybe something like that, but you know, someone's going to line them up and I've got to be able to drive them. That's the
I get what you're saying, but I'm not resigning my F1. F1 is on the list.
That's on the list.
It's right there. There is an F40, F50, and F1. I think these are three, for me, very ultimate cars.
You know? Yeah.
Very.
All very, very cool. Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, thank you very much for coming on the podcast.
Thanks for having me.
It's been good. Being good to chat, and I will definitely be using your website to look up a few cars.
Give it a try, definitely. Yeah.
Cool. Thanks very much.
Okay. Thank you. Bye bye.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.